அன்பர்கள் அனைவருக்கும் எங்களது இனிய காலை வணக்கங்கள். இன்று லைஃப் டிவைன் வெப் மீட்டிங் நடக்க இருக்கிறது. இன்று மிஸ்டர் கேரி அவர்களும் மிஸ்டர் சந்திரசேகரன் அவர்களும் பேச இருக்கிறார்கள். இன்றைக்கு இன்றைய டாபிக் ரீபர்த் அண்ட் அதர் வேர்ல்ட்ஸ், கர்மா, தி சோல் அண்ட் இம்மார்டாலிட்டி. நவ் ஐ எம் இன்வைட்டிங் மிஸ்டர் கேரி டு ஸ்டார்ட் தி ஸ்பீச்.
Good morning. Today we're starting chapter 50. We're almost 90% through the book in terms of the chapters, but we still have 25% of the pages left, which means he saved a lot to the last part of the book to tell us. In the last two chapters, he talked about the philosophy of rebirth and other worlds. And he constantly reminds us, in order for us to understand ourselves, the world, and everything he's saying here, we have to constantly remember the basic premise with which he started the book. If the fundamental reality in the universe is the material world and matter, if that is the starting point and base, which it certainly seems to be to our experience, nothing he says here makes any sense. Talking about other worlds, talking about rebirth, talking about spiritual enlightenment itself makes no sense. Not only that, life makes no sense. If the fundamental reality is matter, we have no way of explaining life, animation, sensation, growth, multiplication. Mind makes no sense. Consciousness makes no sense. Love can only be a chemical and electrical impulse. Thought can only be some vibration in the nerves of the brain. None of it really makes sense if the basic premise of our senses is the real reality. So he spent the whole first half of the book, part one, 28 chapters, describing the reality, the origins and development of the universe as a manifestation of oneness, of whether you call it Brahman or Satchitananda or unity, or by any name. And he explained to us how that pure, infinite, unmanifest, eternal, conscious existence manifests itself, how force, how consciousness is created, how force is created, how the higher planes of its manifestation, how this diversity is created, and eventually in an ascending, descending order, how mind, life, and the material universe are formed. It's that we have to keep in mind when we're looking at these chapters. That's the involution. He has talked in Book 2, Part 1, about the origins of the evolution in the ignorance, in the inconscient, how out of that evolution, individuality is born, consciousness and individuality have emerged. Without this involution, he says, we could have never created individuality. We would have had universality, we would have had an infinite consciousness or an infinite form, but the goal of this manifestation is an infinite manifestation of infinity. And that can only be done through an infinite variety, an infinite diversity, which means individual uniqueness, individual uniqueness. That could only be done when an infinite, we have no words for it, an infinite quality, an infinite consciousness, an infinite existence manifests itself in an infinite variety. Otherwise, it has no way of manifesting itself. And that is the unique role of the individual in the creation. Only through individuality can the full potential, unexpressed potential of the infinite manifest. And only through the progressive development of individuality from a sense of complete separateness, isolation, and inconscience, which is where we come from. We know our origin as the mud or the stone. We know ourselves as completely separate from one another and cut off. We don't really know what we are. We don't know what drives us. We don't know what's coming out or where it's coming from or how it's developing. We don't know what our potential is. We only know that more seems to keep coming out. More seems to be developing, both individually in ourselves, in other people we know. We're constantly surprised, as Darcy is surprised by what he sees from Elizabeth every time he interacts with her. We're by what happens in life around us, by our interactions, by a progressive evolution and unfolding of something that is concealed, hidden within. And he told us in chapter 1, how can anything, he asks and he tells, and the ancients, even in the Vedic Vedantic times, said that that which evolves must be already involved. And so all that has emerged individually and socially, collectively and in the cosmic life, must be in some form there in potential. And if this much has emerged, why should we assume that we have reached the end, that finally after so many millions of years, so many evolutionary stages, why should we think we are the end or if this is the end for us? There was no internet 25 years ago. There was no airplane 75 or television or radio or computer 75 years ago. There were no nation states 200 or 300 years ago. Why should we think we are the end of the manifestation socially, individually, or in terms of the universally, cosmically? So, in chapter 20, he talked about the theory, the philosophy of rebirth, and why rebirth in almost every tradition, not all, but in almost every tradition around the world, rebirth has figured for ages. And it's natural for us, if we listen to modern science, to think this is a figment of imagination, this is a myth, this is wishful thinking. After all, I'm not fully satisfied with this life, so something better will come in the next. And even in most of the Indian tradition, rebirth is not essential from a philosophical point of view, because if the goal is moksha, then all you need to do is, we're here, we're going there, and then the whole thing is over. We're not worried about this. But he says, if you accept his basic premises, rebirth is absolutely essential, because the evolution is a progressive evolution. Obviously, it's not the personality, it's not the ego, it's not the external form that we consider ourselves that's going to be reborn over and over again. If we are, in fact, an evolving spark of an infinite consciousness, which has been evolving all of this way so far, it's obviously not fully manifesting itself. Rebirth is an essential mechanism to enable that progressive manifestation over long periods of time. And therefore, from his point of view, rebirth is essential. It is inevitable. There's no way there could be a progressive evolutionary divine manifestation through the individual if everything has to be done in a limited lifetime. Individuality, he says, and here he varies from much of the tradition. In the Vedantic tradition, individuality is a temporary manifestation of the One. And it's really never clear why the One should manifest as many in ignorance and go through a process of awakening in order to go back to oneness, except for its amusement. The individual has no essential reality or permanence in itself, but he goes back to the origins of the tradition, and he says, individuality is not separate from divinity. Individuality is not separate. We think ourselves as separate from whatever is that perfection or oneness we seek. Individuality is one of the forms through which the one is expressing itself. And whatever is based on the one has an essential right to existence. So he says, we tend to think of that one as a transcendent reality that's outside the world, outside cosmos or universe, that exists in itself. And this is a cycle where for some reason it decided to create something and go back to itself. He says, the transcendent, the universal, and the individual are three forms or three statuses of the same reality. And they are all infinite and they're all eternal. It's obviously not the ego that's infinite that we know, and it's not the ego that's eternal. Something in us, which is the seed of the individual personality, the spark, the inner divine, or by whatever name you call it, the soul, is eternally an eternal expression of that which is eternally unmanifest. And it is that eternal spark in as individual and as cosmos that is progressively evolving in the universe. And that process, he says, is an evolution of consciousness. That which is concealed in form is revealing itself as force and energy and then as consciousness, and then in an ascending series back to full self-awareness of what it is and what the world is and what the transcendent is. And that's the goal of his yoga, is we should discover that infinite oneness in ourselves. We should discover it in the cosmic being and in others around us. And we should know, as the rishis did know, and many saints in different traditions have known, there is a one, a transcendent, unmanifest infinity as well. And all three are expressions of the same reality in play and interaction with each other. In the chapter 21, in the last chapter, he talked about the order of the worlds. And again, from a material point of view, the idea that there should be other planes of existence just doesn't make any sense. Matter is the reality, matter is the starting point and the ending point, and this is the world. World is here. But if you are an infinite consciousness, formless consciousness, trying to create a universe of unconscious forms, the material plane must be the last step in a process of creation. The analogy for us is, if you're an author like Jane Austen and you want to perform, you want to create, if you had the power to create Pride and Prejudice as a reality in life, not as a play or a story in imagination, but if you had that extended power, which we don't have, to actually create it in life, you would have to go through a process of creation that's similar to what the one has done in order to create the universe. First of all, there would have to be a broad conception of a world in which the story takes place. There would have to be an awareness of the values, the culture of that society, all of the invisible planes of existence, the mental worlds of knowledge, from which this, in which this manifestation was going to take place. I find it hard to imagine these ascending planes, but today we know we have a plane of knowledge in the world. Humanity has a plane of knowledge. It's not physical. It doesn't just exist in the minds of individuals. it is a, it's been given different names by different philosophers, but there is a body of knowledge there in the world that is shared by humanity. We have something closer to our imagination. We have the internet, which is not just a connection of wires. They, we call it cyberspace. Nobody can go to cyberspace physically. We can't see cyberspace physically, but it is a plane of awareness or interactions in a subtle plane. It's still based on a material reality. So we get some idea that there can be other planes of reality other than the physical. If life is emerging out of matter, if mind is emerging out of life, if higher levels of consciousness, which sages and saints in all traditions have experienced, are possible, there must be some field or plane in which these realities exist already, even though they're not manifest physically to our senses. So he has talked about in the creation of the universe, in the involution, the infinite consciousness involves itself successively in a stairway of consciousness going all the way down to matter. And in the evolution, we are ascending that stairway and rediscovering the powers that are there that have manifested in the creation of the universe. The only difference is that in our ascension, we are on the surface. We are living in the sense reality of the surface personality. We don't have direct perception of the worlds or the planes of existence from which we are drawing inspiration. The scientist or the genius who comes up with, today is the, I think it's the 100th anniversary of Einstein's announcement of the special theory of relativity, which really changed the world. No genius knows where his inspiration came from, where the idea came from. Ramanujan, the mathematician who saw the theorems that have been proven true, he didn't have the knowledge of where they came from, but he received them in his mind. Beethoven and many of the famous musicians of all different descriptions say that the music soared into them, poured into them. They did not construct the music with their mental imagination. Poets have been filled with that inspiration. So there must be our thoughts. We don't know where all our impulsions come from, where all our emotions come from, because we are on the surface. Our own deeper being, subconscious, subliminal, superconscient being is not conscious to us. But he says, it is from these successive planes of involution where what we are manifesting now, the powers, potentials, resourcefulness, creativity, draw their material. When we go through a challenging experience in our life, Lizzie says to Darcy that when I'm challenged, my courage comes out. Janani, in one of the presentations she did at Dubrovnik last year, she talked about challenges or opportunities, and she mentioned the fact, the historical fact, that great leaders only seem to come at particularly challenging moments in history. During normal times, they may be great in potential, but they're not great in manifestation. Where does the courage of a Churchill come from to confront the tremendous adverse odds that were there for Britain after the rest of Europe had surrendered? Where did the courage of Tito come from to stand up to Stalin when the whole rest of Eastern Europe was shaking in submission? to him and actually go to Moscow. And most people were sure that when he went to Moscow to meet Stalin, he would never come back because he had dared to challenge the absolute authority. Where do those potentials come out in us that were unexpected, that we never knew we had it in us, or in other people which we see developing? He says, we have a subliminal being, and that being is able to draw on a universal nature which is not just physical. It is a vital nature, a mental nature, and a super and spirit, various planes of. The artist draws on it, the warrior draws on it, the great leader draws on it. All of us draw on it in the process of our evolution. We are not fabricating something out of nothing. Just like externally, where do the young people learn, where do they acquire the skills, the behaviors, and the values of the, they draw on the invisible planes of the society. They draw on the knowledge, which is intangible. They draw on the attitudes, the values, the behaviors, the beliefs, in order to build the surface personality. In the same way we consciously or subconsciously draw on our social environment, we subconsciously or subliminally draw on a universal environment of consciousness of which the surface being is not conscious, but internally the subliminal being is. So in this chapter, in chapter 22, he takes these together and talks about what is the meaning of this? If the worlds exist, if the process of rebirth exists, how does this come together? What is the significance of this in the evolution? How does it determine our life experience? And he raises a lot of questions to be answered, and I wish that all of you raise a lot of questions during this session that'll make it more interesting. What or who is it that is reborn? What is it that's reborn? It's fine that something's reborn, but what is reborn? Where do we go, or where does it go between births, or what happens between births? Why do we go to other planes? What purpose does it serve? Is it just a fancy? Is it a wishful thinking? Is it an imagination? What determines the circumstances of our birth? Is it true that our actions in past lives can influence what happens to us in the present and in the future, which is a deeply rooted belief in Indian tradition? Does that explain why some people seem to be lucky and others have bad luck? Does that explain why some things good happen to us even though we didn't do anything, or something bad happens even though we don't think we deserved it? What's the truth of karma? Are we really punished for sins committed in past lives for which we have absolutely no recollection? If karma is real, why is it that sometimes we find that bad people seem to prosper and good people seem to suffer? Why is it that sometimes many people suffer or many people prosper, apparently without deserving it either way? We are all the beneficiaries of the internet today, or of the new technology, or of modern conveniences, or whatever it is. We are all the beneficiaries of the pollution in the cities, or what a global climate change, or whatever it is. How do we relate? How does the individual relate to things which seem to affect the whole collective or many, and not just ourselves individually? Are we each individually responsible for what happens to us, even though it's happening to everybody? Did we each deserve this unprecedented rain that hasn't been there for 10 years or maybe for almost 100 years? Can we each say, I did something and therefore Madras has received these record rains? It's very flattering. But then we have to also say in the years of drought, yes, it's my fault that it's not yours, it's my fault that the rains are not there.
Mary?
Yes, Ashok, good morning.
Good morning. Regarding rebirth, I have a question for which I am trying to get an answer.
Yes.
Why is it that we don't remember who we were in our last life, neither do we know who we are going to become in our next life? For some reason, this memory has been blocked. I don't understand why it's not necessary that we remember who we were in our last life. Is that in any way harmful for the present life to know who we were in our last life? I don't understand why it should be blocked.
That's a great question, and fortunately for me, Sri Aurobindo has given the answer, so I can give you an answer for it. Since I don't remember not only my past life, I don't even remember my early childhood, so that would be a real stretch of the imagination. It's a really good question, and he does answer it. In fact, he answers it both in two ways. First, he says, he answers it to address the current conventional belief about karma. Because if the conventional belief about karma is that we are punished for our sins and rewarded for our virtues. And if that's true, and if it's true that we are punished for our sins of our past lives and rewarded for our virtues of our past lives, and therefore a bad man in this life can be rewarded for what he did in a previous life, what possible meaning could there be in that if we can't remember what we did in the past life? If I'm punished now for something I did in the past life and I can't remember it, it's just like somebody coming up to me after 10 years of knowing me and suddenly saying, I will never talk to you again, walking away. And I said, what did I do? What did I do? At least if you're going to accuse me of something or break a friendship that's been there for 10 years, I should know what I did wrong. Otherwise, how can I correct it? So the fact that we don't remember memories from any past life is a direct contradiction, apparent contradiction of the fact that we may be bearing the consequences of what we did in past lives. It would make no sense. He gives another answer. He also says that for the purpose of our evolution, memory of past lives would be a very serious obstacle. Because we have gained an experience from the past life and we have assimilated a certain knowledge from that experience. If we remember the experience of one or a multitude of past lives now, we'll be constantly reliving the past. We won't be getting the fresh experience for an evolution of our consciousness. You know, once you've had an experience, if you've had a bad experience, the tendency is to remember it and anticipate maybe it's going to repeat under similar circumstances again. It's very difficult to outgrow it. If you've had a great experience, then the next time something happens, your expectations are up that it should repeat. So we'd be living in the past. We wouldn't be living we wouldn't be evolving into the future. And you remember that Mother says that she never remembers her past spiritual experiences. She says, the mind wants to remember, the memory wants to remember, the ego wants to remember because it wants to possess something. The moment we try to possess the past experience, it inhibits the spontaneity and freshness of a future experience. So from a pragmatic point of view of spiritual progress, a memory would be a real obstacle on the surface. He, in fact, says there are lots of people in all traditions. There are so many books written even from about famous people who think they've remembered their past lives and all. Mother has commented that about 99% of that is imagination. Imagination, wishful thinking. It's not absolutely impossible to remember that, but it requires usually a very high level of spiritual experience to be in contact with the consciousness of our being that has gone through those previous experiences. So they usually discount this as an imagination. It's not theoretically impossible, and there are great beings who have done it, but that's not what not what's the norm. So the key here is to the key to answer to the question is, what is it that is reborn? He makes it clear that it's not the surface personality. It's not Ashok Natarajan or Gary Jacobs or any of us that our surface personality has been reborn. And there we have to understand the structure of the human personality. And he says, there is an infinite self, whatever name we call it, Brahman, Atman, a one, and that one in the unmanifest also has an individualized portion, which in the tradition they call Jivatma. It's an eternal, unmanifest individuality, and Sri Aurobindo calls it the spiritual individual. It is that manifests as the soul, and it is the evolution of that soul which he calls the psychic. The true person in us is not the surface personality, is not the ego, it's not the mind, the vital, and the physical formation. It is that spark of eternal consciousness which has individualized itself, which is evolving in time. It is that which has experiences, it's that which puts on a surface personality for the sake of a life. At the end of it, that personality dissolves, it extracts the essential knowledge from that for its growth, for the growth of a subliminal spiritual personality, and it is that is reborn. Not this body, not this personality, not this mind, not this set of memories. If it were, how would we continue to develop? Our goal is not just to be more capable human beings, go to school for a few more years or learn a few more occupations. Our goal is to manifest something that's infinite. This is all for a limited surface experience, so that different powers and capacities of that subliminal being can be developed. Does it answer your question? In many of the traditions, people are thinking it's, sorry.
Somewhat satisfied by your explanation.
Okay.
There is another point where I'm not
please.
So clear.
Yeah.
There is this proverb that's quite widely known, that the sins of the parents are visited on the sons, something like that, on the children. I once extended this proverb with Apana, asked for an explanation. I said the Brahmin community in present-day India is somewhat persecuted by the other communities. Why is it so? He said, you see, the Brahmins in ancient India persecuted the other communities. Now, after the introduction of education and democracy and universal suffrage and all, the tables have turned, and it's now the turn of the Brahmin to be persecuted. Now, I don't find any justice in this argument that the present-day Brahmins should pay for the sins of their forefathers some few centuries ago. He said that is how nature works, and I have heard explanations for the persecution of Jews in the hands of Nazi Germany, saying that 2,000 years ago they killed crucified Jesus, and for that sin they are paying for it now, being killed in Marseille. Now, in what way are the present-day Brahmins responsible for what their forefathers did with their caste privileges? I don't find any justice in this, but this is how it worked.
This is largely a result of a very limited conception of karma. So if we go to karma and discuss it and come back to this at the end of that discussion, I'll address that question. Okay? You tell me if I haven't addressed it by the end of the presentation.
Okay.
In the traditional, let's say, common view of karma, we are punished for our sins. In your case, you're saying for the sins of our forefathers. We're rewarded for the virtues of our past acts. And the only conceivable purpose of this would be that we should eventually receive a certain level of either frustration with life or enlightenment that leads us to moksha. There could be no other really apparent rationale for it. But what he says is, this notion of karma is at best a very, very limited truth. Mostly what it is, there is a truth, but mostly what this is the belief of the vital mind that if I do something good, and usually when we say doing something good, we mean something that we don't really want to do, but we do it because we think we should do it. I should give something to somebody else. I should refrain from doing something that might hurt. I should be generous. I should be thoughtful, and all of those things. The vital would very much like to know that for every sacrifice it makes, there's a benefit. So if I give a gift to somebody, it means I'm going to get something back. This is bargain. This is the vital wanting to bargain. And what parents tell children, don't do that. If you do that, you'll suffer for it. It's the way of trying to, it's not only the parents do it, the society does it. Religions do it. Religions have the list of things. If you do these things, you'll be sinning, you'll go to hell, or you'll have karma, or whatever it is. It is trying to control the irresistible urges of the vital and human beings, and give us an incentive to do the right thing and give us a fear of doing the wrong thing. And that's a strong element of what has emerged as karma. It's not the whole thing, but I'm trying to get that out of way. And so he says, God is not an accountant. God is not a mathematician who's keeping score up there, and if you do all of these things, you go to heaven, and if you do these, you go to hell, and if it's in between, you kind of go first to purgatory, and then, for what you've done, by the way, in a particular lifetime, eternally you're going to suffer, or eternally you're going to be in heaven. So this is really important. Don't waste a minute, and don't make a mistake. Even if you've had a hard childhood, even if you've had difficult circumstances, what you do is going to be eternally counting. He says, actually, this would not be just a system of reward and punishment. It would be a double system. It would be a double count. Because according to this, every time I do something wrong, not only am I going to suffer in this life, but it's going to determine my future as well. And every time I do something good, I'm going to get a benefit here, but I'm also going to get a benefit for eternally in the future. He said, if we really want to understand causality in the universe, we have to abandon a vital conception of it. However, to complicate matters, there are times when this is really what seems to happen. And it seems to happen quite literally, and it's so obvious that it does happen, that if you look at those incidences and generalize from it, it would seem to be a compelling argument for this. In around 1980, the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan, and they had a puppet government of communists there. A few people declared they're communists and called in the Soviet army, and they took over Afghanistan. And the U.S. and the Western NATO countries were really puzzled what to do. This is a major geographic extension. Nothing had happened in this region for of this dimensions. And the U.S. finally came up with a very clever strategy. They decided to train the tribals of Pakistan and on the border, the tribals in Afghanistan who were Islamic fundamentalists. They trained them, they equipped them, and they gave them they encouraged them to follow a path of liberation for their country against the communist, secular heathens who don't even believe in God. And it was such a successful strategy that it eventually drove the Soviets out of Afghanistan. It was the end of Afghan war was very unpopular at home. And when Gorbachev came to power, this was one of the things he was trying to go beyond, because this kind of thing just doesn't work. What happened, they even made a movie of this, by the way, about 8 years ago, about the American congressman who came up with the idea and helped organize it. 20 years later, the United States is attacked. The World Trade Center was attacked by Taliban, not by Taliban. The fundamentalists were in power in Afghanistan, but attacked by Al-Qaeda, who were in Afghanistan. And when the U.S. said, you have to arrest these people and turn them over to us, they said, we won't. And the U.S. ended up invading Afghanistan and fighting against the very people whom they had trained, and ended up in the longest war in U.S. history. Now, we can point to hundreds of incidents like this that seem to support in the individual life and in collective life the very thing that I've just said is not true. There is a truth in it, and therefore we have to see what is the truth in it and what is the superstition or the convention in it. He says the truth that ancient Indian spirituality and many other, not just there, it's there in other traditions, it's there in all the ancient literature knew was that as you put forth an energy, that the quality of that energy tends to come back. The notion of karma reduced that to a very simplistic idea that every act is either good or bad, and the goodness comes back or the bad comes back. That's a very simplistic notion, because no act is simply good or bad. I'm speaking now. Is it good or bad? Well, it's either loud or soft. It may be clear or confusing. It may be pleasant or unpleasant. It may be inspiring or depressing. It can be many different things. If it's poetry, it may be beautiful or not beautiful. If I'm painting, it may be anything. Every act, in fact, has many, many different qualitative dimensions to it. Physical dimensions of how loud the sound is or clear the voice is. Emotional aspects, attitudes behind it, thought behind it. Every act is complex and every act is taking place on many levels, not just the physical level. The notion of karma only put emphasis on the physical part of the act. What about the motive? What about the intention? What about the understanding? You know that if any of us do something really thinking we're doing something nice and to please the other person, but we have a wrong information about that person, and it turns out the one thing we do for them, that you serve the food you think they would like, and it happens to be the food they're allergic to or that they hate all their life, what you do with the best of intention has an opposite result. Intention really matters. But according to karma, it wasn't the intention that matters, it's the act. Oh, you served the food to somebody that they hated, therefore it has a consequence. It's a very, very simplistic way of thinking about it. So he says, the real notion, the real truth of karma is that every energy put forth is a complex reality. Every acts are not only physical acts, a thought is an act. I may not express my thought, but the thought is an energy. The emotion is an energy. Prayer is an energy. Prayer is not something physical. It's you can do it while in any position without moving. An emotion of love is an energy. A creative thought, whatever it is. So all of these energies at all levels evoke responses from nature. This is the first thing. The second way in which karma is not, let's say, not true in the way it's commonly understood is, we are not just living in nature. We are also conscious beings. We also have consciousness and being. And the consequences that we get are not just for the action we have done, but everything depends on our consciousness as well. And we have the power, the whole idea of past consecration or consecration for anything is based on the fact we are not just a mechanical system. Our life is not just a mechanical system governed by universal laws and vibrations of energy as in the physical plane. So there is nature, but there's also conscious being. And in the measure we are conscious, we can cancel out or reverse the consequences of the vibrations that come to us. Because we've been unconscious as humanity, we've been polluting the world. We've been polluting the rivers and forests and everything. There was a time when I was growing up in high school in Los Angeles, you couldn't breathe the air many days. It was so filled with smog, so filled with pollution. I remember driving on the 50 miles from LA to where Leslie's family lived, and it looks like you're in a cloud, look like it's full fog. There's no fog at all. It's just the smog in the atmosphere is so dense you can't see more than 10, 20 feet ahead of you. 20 years later, it was gone. 20 years later, they had cleaned the whole thing up. They had changed the rules, changed the behavior, and what's happening in Delhi today and in Beijing today, we were through that already. In the 1960s, the forests of Europe were all dying from acid rain. They were all the trees were discolored, the leaves were falling off. It looked like it was the end of the forest life. If you grow to places in Europe today, you see the beautiful, rich greenery of the dense forests, because we were conscious, we were able to reverse the determinism of the physical act did have a consequences. We were wastefully, unconsciously polluting, and it was killing everything. And now we introduced a higher level of consciousness, reversed it, and the equation changed. The same is true in our lives. That's the principle of past consecration. We did something out of unconsciousness in the past, and it's true, it does have consequences. But we are not powerless against the past. We can rectify it in consciousness now by raising the consciousness, changing the attitude, changing the intention. And I think all of you and so many devotees have had that experience, personal experience of what happens when you do that. That is changing karma, if in the sense of changing the mechanical determinism of the lower energies. It's also true that our physical consciousness is the least conscious. Our physical bodies are the least conscious part of us, and therefore the most subject to the consequences of a mechanical process of nature. If I eat too much, I get stomach ache. It doesn't matter if I, what my conscious intention is, mostly, to a large extent. If I don't take care of my health, the body tends to break down. We know the laws, we call them the rules of health and hygiene and physical fitness and so forth. It does seem to be, who is the person who's in better health? Is it the good person? It's the person who takes care of their health. Goodness is important, and of course goodness can help the health, because people who are good tend to be happier, they tend to have less tension, and that has an impact on health. But the idea of karma, that because I'm good I should be rich, and because he's bad he should be poor. The person who gets rich is, he may be very hardworking, he may be very skillful, he may be very dedicated and organized, he may be very loyal to all of the people around him, even if they're members of a gang. He may be many things, and his reward is for what he is strong in. The good man who's weak, timid, lazy, who never wants to go out of the house and says, no, I'm good, therefore I should be rich. He's expecting this one quality to do everything. Just because I'm good, it doesn't mean I'm going to have good health. Just because I'm good, it doesn't mean I'll have great knowledge. Who gets the knowledge? It's the student who studies very hard. It's the mind that's constantly questioning and looking for knowledge, and so forth. So this is quite mixed in the tradition. So I've said essentially there is a truth in the energies given out, come back, but it's all at all different levels, and it's all different qualities that come back. It's not just an external machinery. We have conscious will. But he says the key to the whole thing is not to understand the accounting system of karma. The key to the whole thing is to understand the purpose of experience. There is a purpose for our experience. It's not to punish us. There's no punisher up there. There's nobody keeping score and condemning us. After all, if we are ignorant, it's the one who has created or become everything. If ignorance exists in the world, it's a manifestation of that. It would be quite perverse for God to be creating ignorant, even evil people and then punishing them for what he has created. It wouldn't make any sense. There is one purpose in all our experience, and that is the evolution of consciousness. The vital wants to think, there must be something I can do to get what I want. What the vital wants is not what the soul is seeking. The vital wants to be popular. Say, Collins wants everybody to appreciate him. You see, I got an education, I'm a clergyman, Lady Catherine is my patroness, so I am very successful, you must all appreciate me. That's what Collins wants. Darcy wants everybody to recognize his importance, his superior status. When he comes into the, why does he go to a dance at Meryton if he's not going to dance? The only conceivable reason he should go is to announce to people, I'm so important, I come from a high family, I won't dance with you, you can admire me, and I can feel good about, important about myself, because only when I'm with all of those people, I feel superior. That's not what his life is all about. What the vital seeks, what the vital is satisfied with. Lady Catherine's one aspiration in life is, or immediate aspiration we see is, she wants Jane to marry Bingley, and immediately, even before the engagement is there, she runs to tell Lady Lucas, unfortunately your daughters are plain looking and are not so fortunate, I'm very sorry for you, meaning I'm very happy that I can triumph over you. That's the vital ego. So, what is to be rewarded and what is to be punished? What is it we're really seeking? Why have we been born? What is the soul, thank you, what is the soul seeking? What is the purpose of our action? He says it's an adventure of consciousness. It's an adventure of consciousness. Everything that comes to us to awaken the consciousness in ourselves, to help us grow in greater consciousness. When Wickham comes and scandalizes Darcy, there's nothing directly in the story that would warrant Wickham scandalizing Darcy. But we know that Wickham scandalizing Darcy is the greatest good that comes to him. The greatest good comes to him because a completely undeserved accusation is made against Darcy. He says later on, he tells Lizzie at the end of the story, it was a bitter lesson you told me. He doesn't say, you told all lies or misconceptions about me, and I suffered because of it. He doesn't say that. He said, the essence of what you said is true. It was a bitter lesson, but I have learned from it. I realize I was mean and selfish and proud, and I'm a better person today because of it. That's the purpose of our experience. And all those who have accomplished at a high level, all those who have achieved at a high level, and will tell you, have said, the testimony is there, we have it in hundreds or thousands of instances, if it hadn't been for that difficulty I went through, I would have never made this progress. I would have never been capable of this. And I think all of you, if you look back, can also know the same thing. The greatest opportunity and the greatest progresses we have made has been in most cases, or in almost every case, there can be always exceptions because nothing is, has been through the difficulties. So should we say, I'm a good person, therefore no difficulty should ever come to me, meaning I want to stay where I am and be satisfied with what I am. That doesn't mean we should ask for difficulties. Mother warns against it because they will come in abundance. It means whatever comes, we should ask only one question. What is the progress I should make? If something good comes, not that I should gloat, not that I should be satisfied, not that I should celebrate my superiority as Mrs. Bennett tried to do, what should I do so that this good can become something better or can go to other people? Not so I can show I'm better than everybody else, but what's made me happy, how can it make other people, how can other people get this? That's what Karma Yogi did when he discovered the water table in this dry area in Ramapuram. And suddenly his lands rose in value tenfold, and the state bank comes and says, we're willing to get, not one bank, three banks came, we're willing to give you all this money to develop it. His first thought was, I got it, but what about the village? How can they get it? Give it to them, make it possible for them to get it. So rather than triumph and say, I'm such a success and you see my virtues are warranted, how can other people get it? So there is a response to our good fortune which will help it to grow. That's why Mother says gratitude. When something good comes, if the first thing the vital ego says is, you see how good I am, you see how much I deserve it, yes, yes, I did it. I accomplished, and I'm satisfied. And we all, I think, know, at least most of us know, that just cancels the progress. When you feel grateful for it, or you think of extending it or giving it to others, the growth continues. The same thing with the negative things. I keep repeating Darcy's experience because it was so extraordinary. Because a man who's so proud, if everything she said about him was justified, if every accusation she made against him was justified, well, it would have been one thing. But life did not bring true accusations against him. Life brought false accusations against him, so he has every rational let's say the vital ego has every justification for saying, you see, you were wrong about this, you were wrong about that, you don't know what you're talking about, I'm not the problem, you're the problem. Just because he's a handsome man in a red coat, you have foolishly believed him. He doesn't say that. He never finds fault with her. She wants to forget the past. No, no, don't talk about that anymore. She says, why shouldn't I talk about it? What you said was true. Not everything she said was true. But he doesn't go back and point out all of the errors. He points to the truth in what she said and how much it benefited him. That's the sincerity, to grow through the challenges that we face. And this is a formula for unlimited growth. He also answers the question, and I'm coming gradually back to Ashok's. He also answers the question, does karma extend from one life to another? He says, in the measure the soul wills it and wants, feels there's something more to learn, to get from that experience. Otherwise, the memories don't extend, and the karma can't extend either. So, if we see there's a continuity in a community or in a country, which we do, so I don't look at the Afghan war as a punishment for America. I look at it as an essential learning experience. And there's an essential knowledge in that experience for that we shouldn't repeat in the future. And if we don't learn from that experience, we can keep multiplying the problems that we have. We've gone to Afghanistan, we've gone to Iraq, now we're in Syria. And there's something to be learned from our experiences. And until there is, if it's repeating, there's something we should know about it. When it comes to the caste system, it's a most sensitive issue even today when we say we're going beyond caste. So I would like to go back and answer that from what Sri Aurobindo has said about the caste system in its perspective. Yes, Ashok?
You are confusing me a little.
Okay.
You said that Darcy Miller...
Yeah, go ahead.
You said that Darcy was somewhat sensitive to the scandal spread about him by Vikram. And he learnt, and he benefited from that scandal by learning the proper lessons and improving himself. So you are claiming that the scandal spread by Vikram about Darcy in a way did him good. Now are you saying that each and every person should be sensitive to the scandal spread about him by others around and learn lessons?
The fact that a scandal comes to us, or anything comes to us, has a significance for us. It doesn't mean that scandal is true. In Darcy's case, the scandal wasn't true. But if the law of karma, as the tradition has been, as we commonly talk about it, were true, this doesn't make any sense. Darcy's a man of truth. He doesn't speak lies about other people consciously. And he has helped Wickham so much. It's a diametrically opposite. But if we look at it from the way Sri Aurobindo presents it, as the energies that we put forth come back to us, it is true that Darcy's attitude towards the society around him is offensive and insulting. It is scandalous. People were provoked, even at Meryton, not just Mrs. Bennett, even Lizzie was provoked. And he's the one who called Lizzie to her own hearing. He called her tolerable. Presumably, he didn't intend that she should hear it. But it's a scandalous thing to say to a girl that, well, she's only tolerably attractive, and I'm not here to dance with a woman who's ignored by other men. By any standard, it's extremely rude. It can be called, in a figurative way, it's a scandalous behavior. So there was a truth for Darcy that he, in scandal or some offensiveness coming to him from the society, from Wickham, certainly not literally that what Wickham said was completely fabricated, and Darcy doesn't fabricate things. He doesn't intentionally spread scandal about people. In fact, he has kept the secret about Wickham for such a long time. If scandal comes, it doesn't mean, if a frivolous scandal comes, it doesn't mean that we should, that's true. But it also means, it should tell us something about the source of that scandal. There is something we can learn from it, let me put it that way. We can't generalize on what that is unless we know the situation. In this case, Darcy did draw a very valuable lesson from it, and so we could say what it was he learned from it and how he benefited from it enormously. In one sense, you could say that Wickham did him a great favor, because it was because of that he had the motivation. First of all, because of those lies, Lizzie is not an impolite person. There's nowhere in the story where she goes out of her way to speak meanly or provoke anybody. Even when she's with Carolyn, who she really detests and who is constantly provoking her, she does her best just to avoid any confrontation, or she maintains a very good behavior. But because Wickham has told her these lies and she's believed them, She gives up her politeness when Darcy presses her at Hunsford and speaks out her true feelings. He needed that. He needed that intensity of abuse to become conscious of what he was. So it was the falsehood of Wickham that created the necessary intensity for that. We have often in the past used the example of the Count of Monte Cristo, the story, which is inexplicable in any normal sense of karma. This young sailor boy, who's a good boy, an honest man by any intention, friendly, happy, good in his intentions, responsible, very capable, just on the verge of marriage, he's arrested falsely, imprisoned, put in prison for 14 years until he escapes, undergoes untold suffering, is at the point of trying to commit suicide, and just at that moment, the Abbey Faria comes digging his tunnel and comes right to his cell. He discovers the Abbey. He gets a knowledge, not just an intellectual knowledge, but he gets, I mean, the Abbey's almost like a guru to him. He gives him a whole knowledge of life. He develops his personality. He emerges from that prison, not a continuation of the same person, and he's a giant personality there. And incidentally, the Abbey also gives him the treasure map, and he becomes one of the richest people in the whole Europe. It's a story, but it's a story of a radical transformation. Nothing that Edmund has done, we could say he deserved that experience, or would have wanted that experience. But we can't help but see that that experience has brought a tremendous change in him and a development in him and a potential, a growth of consciousness in him that he certainly wouldn't have made otherwise in life. This, he says, is the ground rule for understanding what happens to us, and that's why Mother says in her Rules of Psychic Education, don't go seeking what's pleasant to you. Don't avoid things because they're unpleasant. What comes to you, do it, and make the progress you should make from it. The fastest, best way to outgrow something that's unpleasant is to accept it and make the progress you should get from it. If somebody's giving you trouble, there's a progress you can make and a lesson you can learn from that. And I think many of you have seen in your own experience, I have certainly seen in my experience, that the people who have given me the most trouble with the least justification have done me, with whatever their intention was, have helped me enormously to become better as a result of it. And that's the spirit in which, not to say, okay, I'm justified, they're wrong, and therefore I'm the victim of something. That doesn't get us anything but self-pity. That doesn't help us develop our consciousness. What does Sri Aurobindo say? He says the Indian tradition is not forecasts or any number of castes. The Indian tradition originates from Vedic times in the four orders. The original intention, the original spiritual truth of it was that there are powers of spiritual consciousness which manifest in the individual. They manifest as knowledge, the emotions of the warrior or the ruler, the skills of the craftsman, and the devotion of service. And the original truth that's there in the Vedas was, we have all these capacities. And the fullest development of the human being would be to develop all of these centers of consciousness. And in any one life, we can't develop everything at one time. So in any one life, we may be focusing on the development of some part of our being, either the mental being or the vital being or the physical being or the spiritual being, and getting experiences for that. And it's right for us to follow the path that will help us develop those capacities to their fullest, all of our capacities, not one or the other. This is the original truth of it. Over time, he says, this is the spiritual basis. Over time, the spiritual basis in the Vedic period became, in the period of the Upanishads, a psychological basis that it noticed, people noticed, people have certain propensity for one or the other. He's more of a mental type, or a warrior type, or an artisan type, or one who can serve. And so what was there as a spiritual truth was recognized as a psychological truth. It's an ancient psychological knowledge that there are, which has been rediscovered by modern psychology in their own way, that there are people of different disposition, and that those capacities should be developed. There was still no caste. In the next stage, and he writes about this in Human Cycle for those who are interested in it, what's spiritual and psychological gets translated into society. Well, if your propensities are in knowledge, then you can be studying, or if your propensities are in spirituality, you can be inspiring people. If your propensities are in trade and creativity, you can be in those fields. And there, the society created the outer mechanisms for these things to, just like a scientist can go and do research, or an entrepreneur can go into business, or a militant person can go into the military and become a military leader, or an artist can go and pursue art. Society created the external social institutions to enable the psychological propensities and capacities to express. There's still no caste. But what happens is, when the father who's been studying scholarship for such a long time, or pursuing his spirituality, or has learned the Vedas, or has learned the arts, or is a skilled craftsman, what does he want? He didn't complete anything, because we never complete anything in one life. I have spent my whole life learning the Vedas. What am I going to do with that? It should continue. So my son should continue what I have done. I have been a painter. I have developed new methods. I have been a skilled artisan or a sculptor or whatever it is. It should continue. Somebody must handle the tradition, follow up. My knowledge must be passed on. So it should continue. So what was originally a spiritual and psychological truth, and then a social institution, became handed down biologically as, no, my son is of my caste, my son should perpetuate. And gradually he describes the process by which a spiritual truth, which was socially institutionalized like all social institutions, eventually loses the spirit and meaning with which it's intended, and simply becomes, which is your blood. Your spiritual destiny is, instead of your spiritual destiny determining everything, your blood determines everything. Who was your parents and grandparents and forefathers? That is your, and that's what you see in the story with Lady Catherine. Lady Catherine wants to be worshipped and respected because for our 10 generations or 10 centuries, her great-great-great-great-great-grandfather was a warrior, and he was knighted by the king, made a lord, and given a territory, and she's been living off the past heritage, though there may have not have been a warrior in her family for 400 years. She lives by the past and clings to the tradition. Dr. Thorne, you know the story. Dr. Thorne is an impoverished doctor, country doctor, who rides on a donkey and mixes medicines, but whoever he meets, he remembers that he can trace his lineage back for 9 centuries. The Thorns. He's so proud of his lineage, he lives in the imagination of the past, and he's such a proud man because of that, because somebody in the past did something. And this is when anything gets translated down to the physical level and loses the spiritual inspiration with which it was intended. So, what's the answer for this? Sri Aurobindo says, and he says it all in that book, he says, "What? There's been effort. Okay, it's true. It's true that not everybody who's a Brahmin is spiritual and knowledgeable, and not everybody who's a Kshatriya is courageous or a leader. He may be frightened like Sambhu and running in the other direction. Then we'll try to clean things up. All right, it's true there's a little irregularities and it's not quite right. We'll try to adjust it. We try to reinvigorate the old tradition." And Sri Aurobindo says it never works. You reinvigorate it, and there have been reformers who came around to reinvigorate the caste system and bring back its spirit many times in the past. It works for 10 years, or it works in one place, or it works for 50 years, and then the whole thing is forgotten and it degenerates again. He says nature requires that a dead institution which has lost its fundamental meaning has to be destroyed, not to give up all that's been acquired in the past, but so the real truth that was started with can reemerge freshly and creatively. The caste system still exists in the minds of people. It's still very much alive in the tradition. So I think the right way to argue things is not that somebody's being punished for something or else. As long as we still identify with this institution and believe in it and believe we're members of it, we have a progress to make. And what happens to us and what happens to our community is to help us overcome that consciousness of the past, which is a real barrier to our own future. For our own future progress, for individually and collectively, for the future progress of India, we have to outgrow the dead relic of the past and rediscover Indian spirituality. It's not there in the caste system. The truth of the Vedas has been forgotten. It's lost. The truth of the Upanishads has been forgotten. The mantras are repeated in every ceremony and nobody knows what it means. It's all 99% superstition now, even though it was founded on truth. But the spirituality in this country is 100% real. And that spirituality is there in the Sudra and the Kshatriya and the Vaishya and the Brahmin and in the outcast. And how are we going to get that back? So what happens, not just to one caste, what happens to any caste, we should look at it and understand this is India's reawakening. It has to go. If it doesn't go, India can never rise to her spiritual greatness. He says India's destiny is to become the guru to the world, to share spirituality to the world. Do you really think that the rest of the world is going to accept 4 castes and join? We're all disqualified. It doesn't matter how long I'm in India and how many children I have. I can never become. What is your message to the world? What is it that you really have to offer to the world? What is it that you have found? Is the truth that you have found in your life the truth of caste? is your real value, is the most valuable thing in your life the thing of caste, then I would say, then you have certainly not gotten anything from Sri Aurobindo and Mother. You have missed the fundamental message. Rather, I would say, as the more we're conscious of caste, the further we are from Mother and Sri Aurobindo, the further we are from receiving what they have to offer. And the best thing for us each is to be challenged to outgrow it. And whatever that is, whether it's whatever the caste may be. Having said that, I want to represent it a complex reality in a more balanced way. I said it strongly to try to make a point. But it's also true, like everything else, reality is complex. And any simple version of reality is a gross misrepresentation of truth. It's also true, Appa says, that caste has been a great repository of cultural development in the country. That through this unique system, which has definitely become decadent and perverse in many, many respects, as all social institutions have become everywhere in every part of the world, in spite of that, it has served a cultural purpose, and that is, these communities, hundreds, thousands of different communities, have each focused positively on developing certain attributes of human nature and society, values, skills, knowledge, mode of relationship, each of which is fundamentally of value to the society and to humanity. The problem has not come from the positive contributions of each caste. The problem has come from the exclusivity. This is what separates us. If every caste decides our mission is to share what we have with the rest, whether it's the artisan or the leader, the kshatriya or the Brahmin, whatever it is, that was the problem. What Sri Aurobindo wrote about the problem for the Brahmin was, like everybody else, the kshatriya wanted to keep power. Once I'm the ruler, my son should be the ruler, my grandchildren should be the ruler, it should go on. Nobody else should rule. What? This is my power. This is my capacity. The Brahmin caste tried to keep the knowledge to itself. Otherwise, we're not important. It's the only thing we have. The only thing we have. If we don't keep it, then we'll be worthless. He said the real spirit, original spirit, was to give it to all. And many of the great rishis in the Vedic times were not Brahmins at all. They were Kshatriyas and other things. Sri Aurobindo himself is not a Brahmin. And many of the great saints weren't in all times. So there is a truth in growing beyond. Let's not throw out the value. The problem is the limitation. The problem is the... See, Darcy has wonderful qualities. There's wonderful qualities, but they don't come out because he's constantly trying to say, I'm not like you, I'm not like that, I keep away from everybody else, I'm very proud and self-important. Only when that petrified wood, that offensive exterior is broken, those qualities come out. He has a capacity for leadership, for goodness, for self-giving, even for joy, which is really amazing, for love and joy, which we never saw on the surface, it comes out. So how rich this country will be if instead of each community trying to preserve its uniqueness, if each community tries to give the richness and the values that it possesses to the country as a whole, then India becomes a giant. For 2,000 or 4,000 years, whatever it is, you have been developing precious knowledge of life, values, skills, capacities for relationship, for capacities for accomplishment in different fields. But the breaking and segmentation of life, what did it do to spirituality? It led spirituality away from life to go to moksha. It impoverished the life of the country. From the golden age of the Vedic times, it became one of the poorest countries in the world. That shows what happens when we divide things. when we put it back together, this is a country that has a cultural reservoir of, to share to the world. It will make India a giant, but the goal is not to make India a giant. The goal is the evolution of humanity. We don't want one next other country to dominate over the others. We want humanity to evolve, and India has a rich heritage to do it. You can't save the world unless you save India. You can't do that unless we come out of the box and the limitations. So I think the best way to think about this is we are all still living in the past, and the problems that come with caste or even religion and everything else are there to say we've got to move beyond this. Not we've got to defend our identity, or we've got to get our right and our quota, or we've got to look out for ourselves. We've got to go beyond this and really create a culture, a rich, integrated culture for the society that's viable in the future. I can tell you my own view is, though all of you or most of you have relatives and many children in the U.S. and all, the answer is not there. We're very good on technology and practical organization, and if you want a computer or an internet or something like that, it's fine. But if you want a harmonious, successful, fulfilling social and psychological and spiritual life, the answer is not there. If you want to do have better schools, okay. Or if you want better science, go to Europe and the West. But if you want to know how to raise, develop human relationships, the answers are not there. Now there's so learn from the rest. Get ready to give what India has. In its present form, nobody wants it. And no, it's not ready. The gift is not ready. The package is filled with so many things. You've got to first get rid of them and let it come out.
Hey, one thing that struck me about Mother's writing.
About Mother's writings, yes.
Nowhere in any of the writings has she come down on the caste system. Just merely brushed it off as something unrelated to spirituality.
Yes.
What could that mean?
That simply means that she knows how deeply rooted it is, and anybody who really understands her message would understand that it has no place. Look at how she treated people. There was no caste system in the ashram. There was no caste discrimination in the ashram. She didn't bring in people by for that reason or position people for that reason. But she understood how deeply rooted it is in the society. She had young children, women, riding on cycle around Pondicherry in their shorts in the 1950s. Even today, it'll be an outrage in many parts of Tamil Nadu to see a girl dressed like that. She was an iconoclast. She did not allow the social inhibitions of the time to dictate to her. But she also was not trying to create, her goal was not a social revolution of the time. She was trying to build it there. So that was not the time to speak out on those things. But I think what Sri Aurobindo's written about it is very clear and very positive for anyone who wants to understand. And he didn't dwell on it because that was 100 years ago. Even 100 years later, it's still controversial, no? So the time has to come. I'm very glad you raised the point. If the distinctions and divisions between the caste are overcome and they come together, what will happen to the future development of the society? Will something be lost in the process of this? Let me answer it this way. First of all, it's already happening. There was a time, presumably, when education was almost exclusively in certain communities, not only in India, but all over the world. originally in Europe, education was with the clergy, with the priestly class in the monasteries, and then got extended to the aristocracy, and today is extended to the whole society. So the process of something being developed in a pocket, in a compartment, and being extended universally is a common social process which we now see globally. Papermaking developed in China becomes global. Money developed in ancient Greece becomes global. This has been the process of human evolution all the time. So one answer is it's not new. Even in India, what I'm saying, for example, many Brahmins go into business today. And the educational field, the knowledge field, is filled with people from all castes. People in the military today come from all castes. People in the administration today come from all castes. So already there is an intermixing. I think I have two answers. One is, whenever you take a developed capacity and bring it in contact with others that are different, it's a creative moment. And all the evolution of society, whether it's two personalities meeting like Darcy and Elizabeth and the sparks fly, because they're really different people. I mean, she's outgoing, cheerful, sociable, happy. He's quiet, contained, aloof, kind of morose, somewhat depressed. And look at what gets created by that contact. The countries, the cultures meeting each other. If individuals meeting each other, cultures meeting each other. So that is the process of creativity. Nations, civilizations meeting each other, it is very creative. So I think in the process, everything starts in isolation and gradually extends to the collective. So most of the things we have today are shared, are almost universal. Access to education, access to healthcare. Of course, still at some levels of the society. It's not permeated down. It's not everywhere. But when I came to India 45 years ago, the differences between what was available here and, you know, what was available there, I was talking about medical care, you know. So this process is a common process. It's also a creative process. In the process of extension, we also know it is a process that tends to dilute things, like education gets diluted when you try to make it universal. The standard of what is there is not what was there when it was in a pocket. So you've raised a great question to think about. I have not fully thought about it, that cycle. We must have enough experience to know what happens. Say, there was a time when the U.S. was founded, the Declaration of Independence said all men are created equal and have a right to certain inalienable right, life, liberty, pursuit of happiness. But when they wrote it, they really meant all white males. They didn't mean women. They didn't mean blacks or other races. So if we trace the process of how it has been extended, the rights, it's true, when the Magna Carta was done in, 1088 or 66, whatever it was, in Britain, which is considered the base of the roots of democracy in England, it was only the rights of the nobility, not the rights of anybody else. But gradually it's been extended. So I think it's a good topic for study, and it's a good question to ask, and of course, and what we can learn from past experience, both in terms of what positive country, I think nobody will doubt today that every society is better because education is becoming universalized. And that's why every society is pursuing it. Not just because it's a right, but because no society can prosper today without educated people. And there's a competition to keep educating them more, because we recognize the whole welfare of the society depends on the knowledge of everybody, not just of a group. So I think it's pretty clear to me what the positive impact will be, but how do you do it in such a way that you don't lose something, or you may lose it in its translation, but it may grow in its essence? For example, today we've discussed it some, and we've discussing it in the academy a lot. I think there's no question today that education has to spread much further, and that in that process something is lost in translation. But it's also true that the finest education today, the finest institutions, is very insulated and isolated, and maybe challenge to the system and breakdown is really what's needed to release the original inspiration. I don't see that vibrancy of real creativity and originality even in the, you know, in the best institutions. So maybe we need to be challenging every social institution becomes, I think, in other words, maybe it will lead to another round of creativity and a rebirth of the real essence of what education is about, or anything is about. It will help us get back to revive the spirit. That's his theme in the human cycle. When the age of individualism comes and you try to extend things and you break down the limitations, it leads to a new period of subjectivity where you rediscover the subjective core. If India rediscovers the subjective truths on which the original caste system was built, it's not going to be the truths of what separates us. It's going to be the human truths that have the powers of capacity that need to be developed in everybody.